Chapter 18. March 15th, 10:10 a.m. Along the Volga River, Russia. As ugly as the Marussia SUV had been, Tucker had no complaints about the vehicle. In the end, it had saved their lives. That and the soft mud at the bottom of the ditch. Tucker turned his back on the overturned vehicle. The others wobbled along the shoulder of the road. After extracting them from the SUV and doing a quick triage, he managed to rouse Utkin, who helped him with Anya and Bukalov. In all, the group had sustained bruises and a smattering of cuts and abrasions. Bukalov suffered the worst, with a dislocated shoulder and a slight concussion. Tucker had managed to pop the old man's shoulder back into place while the doctor was still asleep. The concussion would take time and rest. But now was not the time to stop moving. Tucker led them to their new car, their attacker's dark blue Peugeot 408. Aside from a dent in the front bumper, the sedan remained unscathed. Whomever had rammed them off the road knew what they were doing. Tucker searched the car for transmitters or GPS units, but found none. As Anya helped Bukalov into the car, Utkin pulled him aside. "What is it?" Tucker asked, wanting to get moving. Utkin acted rather furtive.
"You'd better see this."
He slipped a cell phone into Tucker's hand. It was the only phone they had found amid the attacker's possessions.
"Look at the photo I found in the digital memory."
Tucker squinted at a grainy image of himself on the screen. He was seated at a computer workstation, his hands frozen in midair over the keyboard. With a sinking feeling in his gut, he recognized the location. It was that dingy internet cafe in Dimitrovgrad. "Someone had taken a picture of me." Not knowing what to make of it, Tucker emailed the photo to his own phone, then deleted the original. He scrolled to the phone's address book and found it empty, same with the recent calls. It had been sanitized. Frustrated, Tucker removed the phone's battery case and SIM card and crushed them both with his heel. He crossed the road and threw the remains down into the ditch. He took a moment to consider the meaning of the photo. Clearly, someone had been covertly following them. But how? And who? He glanced to the overturned SUV. Could there have been a hidden tracer planted on the Marussia? He didn't know. Couldn't know. In fact, there were far too many unknowns. He faced Utkin. "Have you shown the others this photo?"
"No."
"Good. Let's keep this between us for now." A few minutes later, they were again racing along the Volga River. Aside from a desire to get off the main road and put some distance between themselves and the ambush site, Tucker had no immediate plan. After 10 miles, he turned off the highway and onto a dirt road that led to a park overlooking the Volga. He pulled in, and everyone climbed out. Utkin and Anya helped Bukalov to a nearby picnic table. Tucker walked to the rocky bluff above the thick-flowing river. He sat down, needing to think, to regroup. He let his legs dangle over the edge and listened to the wind whistle through the skeletal trees. Kane trotted over and plopped down beside him. Tucker rested his hand on the shepherd's side.
"How are you feeling, buddy?"
Kane thumped his tail.
"Yeah, I'm okay too.
Mostly." He had cleaned the gash on Kane's head, but he wondered about any psychic damage. There was no way of knowing how the shepherd felt about killing that man on the road. His partner had killed in combat before, and it seemed to have no lasting impact on him. Well, for Tucker, that particular onion was more layered. After Abel's death, after leaving the service, Tucker had come to appreciate certain parts of the Buddhist philosophy. But he knew he'd never match Kane's Zen mindset, which, if put into words, would probably be something like, "Whatever has happened, has happened." As he sat, he was torn between the instinct to run hard for Volgograd and his desire to take it slow and cautious. Still, many things troubled him.
It was why he had stopped here.
Four men, he thought. Why only four? Back at the ambush site, he had checked them for identification and found nothing but driver's licenses and credit cards. But the tattoos they bore confirmed them as Spetsnaz. So why hadn't the enemy landed on them with overwhelming force? Where were the platoon of men and helicopters like back at Nerchinsk? Somehow, this current action reeked of rogue ops. Perhaps someone in the Russian Ministry of Defense was trying to snatch Bukalov without the knowledge of their bosses. But for now, that wasn't the most pressing question concerning Tucker. He knew the ambush couldn't have been a chance accident. So how did the enemy know where to find them? He pictured the photo found on the phone. What did that mean? Utkin joined him, taking a seat at the bluff's edge.
Good view, yes?
I'd prefer to be staring at the Statue of Liberty.
That got a chuckle out of Utkin.
I would like to see that, too. I've never been to America.
Let's hope I can get you there.
So, have you figured out a plan? Where to go from here?
I know we have to reach Volgograd.
But you're worried about another ambush.
It didn't require an answer. Changing the subject, Utkin waved an arm to encompass the river and region.
Did you know I grew up around here?
Actually, Tucker did. He'd read it from the man's dossier, but he remained silent, sensing Utkin wanted to talk, reminisce.
It was a tiny village along the river, about 50 miles south. My grandfather and I used to fish the Volga when I was a boy.
It sounds like a nice childhood.
It was, thank you. But I meant to make a point. You wish to reach Volgograd, yes?
Tucker glanced over to him, crinkling his forehead.
And you wish to stay off the highway,
Utkin said.
That would be good.
Well, there is another way.
Utkin pointed his arm toward the river below.
It worked for thousands of years. It can work for us now.
11:01 a.m. Tucker had one last piece of business to address before moving on. He asked Anya to stay with Bukalov at the park. He instructed Kane to guard them. For this last chore, he needed Utkin's help. Climbing back into the Peugeot, Tucker headed out into the tangle of the remote river roads. He followed Utkin's directions. It took less than an hour to find the abandoned farmhouse tucked away in a forest.
This was once part of an old collective, Utkin explained. It's at least 150 years.
Tucker used the remote to pop the trunk. They both stared down at the bound figure inside, his mouth secured with duct tape. He was the last of those who had ambushed them, the boy of 19 or 20.
Why did you let him live?
Utkin whispered. Tucker wasn't exactly sure. He simply couldn't execute someone in cold blood. Instead, he had clubbed the kid with the butt of his gun, bound him up, and tossed him in the trunk. The boy stared at Tucker and Utkin with wide eyes. They pulled him out and marched him toward the farmhouse. Utkin opened the front door, which shrieked on its hinges. The interior was what Tucker had imagined. Knotty plank walls and floors, boarded-up windows, low ceilings, and layers of dust on every surface. Tucker pushed the boy inside and sat him down on the floor. He peeled the tape from the boy's mouth.
Can you translate?
He asked Utkin.
Are you going to interrogate him?
Tucker nodded. Utkin backed up a step.
I don't want to be a part of any...
Not that kind of interrogation. Ask him his name.
Utkin cooperated and got an answer.
It's István.
Tucker took the boy through a series of benign personal questions designed to massage his defenses. After 5 minutes, the kid's posture relaxed, his
rat-in-a-cage expression fading. Tucker waved to Utkin. Tell him I have no plans to kill him. If he cooperates, I'll call the local police and tell them where to find him.
He's relieved, but he says you must beat him, for effect. Otherwise, his superiors will...
I understand. Ask him his unit.
It's Spetsnaz, like you thought, but he and his team had been assigned to the Russian military intelligence.
The GRU?
That's right.
The same as the Spetsnaz at Nerchinsk. Who did his unit report to at the GRU?
A general named Kharzin, Artur Kharzin.
And what was their job?
To track down Bukolov. His group was told to intercept our car here.
By Kharzin?
Yes, the order came from Kharzin.
This guy must be one of Bukolov's mysterious Arzamas generals. And once they got hold of the doctor, Tucker asked, what were they to do?
Return him to Moscow.
Why does General Kharzin want him?
He doesn't know.
Tucker pulled out his cell phone and showed the grainy image from the internet cafe to their captive. How and when did you get this?
By email,
Utkin translated.
Yesterday afternoon.
How did they know where to intercept us? Utkin shook his head.
He was just given the order.
Do you believe him?
Yes, I think so.
Let's find out. Abruptly, Tucker pulled the magnum from his jacket pocket and pressed it against the boy's right kneecap. Tell him I don't believe him. He needs to tell me why Kharzin wants Bukolov. Utkin translated Tucker's demand. Istvan started jabbering, white-faced and trembling.
He says he doesn't know,
Utkin blurted, almost as scared as the kid.
Something about the plant or flower, a discovery of some kind, the weapon. He swears on the life of his son.
Tucker kept the magnum pressed against the guy's kneecap. Utkin whispered,
Tucker, he has a son.
Tucker did his best to keep his face stony. A lot of people have sons. He's going to have to give me a better reason than that. Tell him to think hard. Has he forgotten anything?
Like what?
Is there anyone else after us? Anyone besides the GRU? Utkin questioned the boy, pressing him hard. Finally, he turned and stammered,
He says there's a woman. She is helping Kharzin.
A woman?
Someone with blonde hair. He only saw her once. He doesn't know her name, but he believes that she was hired by Kharzin as some sort of mercenary or assassin.
Tucker pictured Felice Nilsson. She was old news. Go on. Tell him I already know about...
He says after they pulled her from the river, she was taken to a hospital.
Tucker felt as though he'd been punched in the stomach. Has he seen her since?
No.
Could she truly have survived? He remembered the strong current, the icy water. He pictured Felice swimming or being pulled along by the flow. Maybe finding a break in the ice, maybe radioing for rescue. If the Spetsnaz had found Felice quickly enough, there was a slight chance she could have made it. Tucker took the magnum away from Istvan's knee and shoved it into his jacket pocket. The boy leaned back, gasping with relief. Tucker was done here. As he turned away, he imagined that cunning huntress coming after him again. But he felt no fear, only certainty. I killed you once, Felice. If I have to, I'll do it again. Chapter 19. March 15th, 1:15 p.m. North of Volgograd, Russia. Back in the Peugeot, Tucker continued working his way south, staying off the main road. Utkin's knowledge of the area came in very handy as he pointed to rutted tracks and cow paths that weren't on any map. Anya broke the exhausted silence and expressed a fear she had clearly been harboring.
What did you do with the young man from the trunk?
Are you asking me if I killed him? Tucker said.
I suppose I am.
He'll be fine. Conditionally, he added silently. They had left Eastbound duct-taped to a post at the old farmhouse. His parting words to the kid had been, "This is your one free pass. Appear on the field of battle again, and I'll kill you."
Please, tell me you didn't hurt him.
I didn't hurt him. Tucker glanced at her in the rearview mirror. Her blue eyes stared back at him in the reflection. She finally turned away.
I believe you.
Following Utkin's directions, Tucker drove south for another 30 miles, reaching a farming community near the Volga's banks.
The village of Sherbadovka,
Utkin announced. If you say so. Half the buildings were either boarded up or looked abandoned. At the far end, a narrow dirt road led in a series of sharp switchbacks from the top of a bluff to a dock that hugged the river. They all unloaded at the foot of the pier, a ramshackle structure of oil-soaked pylons and gap-toothed wooden planks. Utkin waved to a man seated in a lawn chair at the end. Floating listlessly beside him was what looked to be a rust-streaked houseboat, or maybe tent boat was the better description. A blue tarpaulin stretched over the flat main deck. Utkin talked with the man for a few minutes, then returned to the car.
He can take us to Volgograd. It will cost 5,000 rubles, not including the fuel.
The price wasn't Tucker's concern. Can we trust him?
My friend, these people do not have telephones, televisions, or radios. Unless our pursuers plan to visit every fisherman personally between Saratov and Volgograd, I think we're safe. Besides, the people here do not like the government. Any government.
Fair enough.
In addition, I know this man well. He is a friend of my uncle. His name is Vadim. If you are in agreement, he says, we can leave at nightfall.
Tucker nodded. Let's do it. After storing their gear in the storage shed of Vadim's boat, Tucker drove the Peugeot back toward Sherbadovka. A mile past the village, following Utkin's crude map, he reached a deep tributary to the Volga. He drove to the edge, put the car in neutral before turning it off, and climbed out. Kane followed him, stretching, while searching the woods to either side. Tucker quickly tossed the keys into the creek, got behind the car, and shouldered it into the water. He waited until the Peugeot sank sullenly out of view. He then turned to Kane.
Feel like a walk?
8:30 p.m. Captain Vadim stood on the dock, a glowing stub of a cigar clenched between his back molars. The stocky, hard man with a week of beard scruff and hardly more stubble across his scalp stood a head shorter than any of them. Though it was already growing colder following sunset, he wore only a shirt and a pair of stained jeans. He waved Tucker and the others toward a plank that led from the pier to his boat. He grumbled something that Tucker took as welcome aboard. Anya helped Bukulov tiptoe warily across the gangplank. Kane trotted across next, followed by Tucker and Utkin. Vadim yanked the mooring lines, hopped aboard, and pulled the gangplank back to the boat's deck. He pointed to an outhouse-like structure that led below to the cabins and spoke rapidly. Utkin grinned.
He says the first-class accommodations are below. Vadim has a sense of humor.
If you could call it that, Tucker thought.
I should take my father to his cabin, Anya said. He still needs some rest.
Bukulov did look exhausted, still compromised by his concussion. He slapped at Anya's hands as she tried to help him.
Father, behave.
Quit calling me that. Makes me sound like an invalid. I can manage.
Despite his grousing, he allowed himself to be helped below. Tucker turned to find Kane standing at the blunted bowsprit. his nose high, taking in the scents. That's a happy dog. To the west, the sun had set behind the bluffs. The afternoon's brisk wind had died to a whisper, leaving the surface of the Volga calm. Still, underneath the surface, sluggish brown water swirled and eddied. The Volga's currents were notoriously dangerous. Utkin noted his attention.
"Don't fall in. Vadim has no life rings. Also, Vadim does not swim."
"Good to know." With everyone aboard, Vadim hopped onto the after deck and took his place behind the wheel. With a rumble, the diesel engine started. Black smoke gushed from the exhaust manifolds. The captain steered the bow into the current, and they were off. "How long to Volgograd?" Tucker asked.
Utkin glanced back to Vadim. "He says the current is faster than normal, so about 10 hours or so."
Tucker joined Kane, and after 20 minutes, Anya returned topside. She stepped over to him. Chilled, she tugged her wool jacket tighter around her body, unconsciously accentuating her curves. "How's your father doing?" he asked.
"Finally sleeping."
Together, they stared at the dark shoreline slipping past. Stars glinted crisply in the clear skies. Something brushed Tucker's hand. He looked down to find Anya's index finger resting atop his hand. She noticed it and pulled her hand away, curling it in her lap.
"Sorry, I did not mean to..."
"No problem," he replied. Tucker heard footsteps on the deck behind them. He turned as Utkin joined them at the rail.
"That's where I grew up,"
the man said, pointing downstream toward a set of lights along the west bank.
"The village of Kolishkino."
Anya turned to him, surprised.
"Your family were farmers? Truly? Fishermen, actually."
"Hmm," she said, noncommittally. Still, Tucker heard, and he was sure Utkin did too, the slight note of disdain in her question and response. It was an echo of Bukalov's similar blind condescension of the rich for the poor. Such sentiment had clearly come to bias Bukalov's view of Utkin as a fellow colleague. Whether Anya truly felt this way, Tucker didn't know, but parents often passed on their prejudices to their children. Tucker considered his own upbringing. While his folks had died too young, some of his antisocial tendencies likely came from his grandfather, a man who lived alone on a ranch and was as stoic and cold as a North Dakota winter. Still, his grandfather treated his cattle with a surprisingly warm touch, managing the animals with an unusual compassion. It was a lesson that struck Tucker deeply and led to many stern conversations with his grandfather about animal husbandry and responsibility. In the end, perhaps it was only natural to walk the path trod by those who came before us. Still, after a time, Anya drifted away and headed below to join her father.
"I'm sorry about that," Tucker mumbled.
"It's not your fault," Utkin said softly.
"I'm still sorry."
9:22 p.m. Below decks, Tucker lounged in what passed for the mess hall of the boat. It was simple and clean, with lacquered pine paneling, several green leatherette couches, and a small kitchenette, all brightly lit by bulkhead sconces. Except for the captain, everyone had eventually wandered here, seeking the comfort of community. Even Bukalov joined them, looking brighter after his nap, more his old irascible self. Tucker passed out snacks and drinks, including some jerky he'd found for Kane. The shepherd sat near the ladder, happily gnawing on a chunk. Eventually, Tucker sat across from Bukalov and placed his palms on the dining table. "Doctor, it's high time we had another chat."
"About what? You're not going to threaten us again, are you? I won't stand for that."
"What do you know about Artur Harzin, a general tied to Russian military intelligence?"
"I don't know anything about him.
Should I? He's the one hunting us. Harzin seems to think your work involves biological weapons. So convinced, in fact, he's ordered all of us killed. Except you, of course. He turned to Anya. What do you make of all this?
You'll have to ask my father.
She crossed her arms.
This is his discovery.
Then let's start with a simpler question. Who are you?
You know who I am.
I know who you claim to be, but I also know you've been pumping me for information since we met. You're very good at it, actually, but not good enough. Actually, he wasn't as confident on this last point as he pretended to be. While Anya had asked a lot of questions, such inquiries could just as easily be born of innocent curiosity and concern for her father.
"Why are you doing this?" Anya shot back. "I thought such suspicions were settled back in Dimitrovgrad."
"And then we were ambushed. So tell me what I want to know, or I can take this discussion with your father in private. He won't like that." She stared with raw-eyed concern and love toward Pukalov. Then, with a shake of her head, she touched her father's forearm, moving her hand down to his hand. She gripped it tightly, possessively. Pukalov finally placed his hand over hers.
"It's okay. Tell him."
Anya looked up at him, her eyes glassy with tears.
"I'm not his daughter."
Tucker had to force the shock not to show on his face. That wasn't the answer he had been expecting.
"My name is Anya Malinov, but I'm not Dr. Bukalov's daughter."
"But why lie about it?" Tucker asked. Anya glanced away, looking ashamed.
"I suggested this ruse to Abram. I thought if he told you that I was his daughter, you would be more inclined to take me with you."
"You must understand," Bukalov stressed. "Anya is critical to my work. I could not risk your refusing to bring her along."
No wonder this part of the plan was kept from Harper.
"But I meant what I said before," Bukalov pressed. "Anya is critical to my work."
"And what is that work? I'm done with these lies. I want answers." Bukalov finally caved.
"I suppose you have earned an explanation, but this is very complicated. You may not understand."
"Try me."
"Very well. What do you know about Earth's primordial history? Specifically about plant life that would have existed, say, 700 million years ago.
"Absolutely nothing."
"Understandable. For many decades, a hypothesis has been circulating in scientific communities about something called LUCA, Last Universal Common Ancestor. Essentially, we're talking about the Earth's first multicellular plant. In other words, the seed, or genesis for each and every plant that has ever existed on the Earth. If LUCA is real, and I believe it is the progenitor of every plant form on this planet, from tomatoes and orchids to dandelions and Venus flytraps."
"You use the word hypothesis, not theory," Tucker said. "No one has ever encountered LUCA before?"
"Yes and no. I'll get to that shortly. But first, consider stem cells. They are cells that hold the potential to become any other cell in the human body if coaxed just right. A blank genetic slate, so to speak. By manipulating stem cells, scientists have been able to grow an ear on a mouse's back. They've grown an entire liver in a laboratory, as if from thin air. I think you can appreciate the significance of such a line of research. Stem cell research is already a multi-billion dollar industry, and will only escalate. It is the future of medicine."
"Go on."
"To simplify it to the basics, I believe LUCA is to plant life what stem cells are to animal life. But why is that important? I'll give you an example.
Say someone discovers a new form of flower in Brazil that treats prostate cancer. But the rainforests are almost gone, or the flower is almost extinct, or maybe the drug is prohibitively expensive to synthesize. With Luca, those problems vanish. With Luca, you simply carbon copy the plant in question.
Bukalov grew more animated and grandiose.
Or better yet, you use Luca to replenish the rainforest itself. Or use Luca in combination with, say, soybeans to turn barren wastelands into arable land. Do you see the potential now?
Tucker leaned back. Let me make sure I understand. If you're right, Luca can replicate any plant life because in the beginning, it was all plant life. It's as much of a genetic blank slate as stem cells.
Yes, yes. I also believe it can accelerate growth. Luca is not just a replicator species, but a booster as well.
Anya nodded, chiming in.
We can make flora hardier. Imagine potatoes or rice that could thrive where only cacti could before.
All this sounds great, but didn't you say this was all an unproven hypothesis?
It is, Bukalov said, his eyes glinting. But not for much longer. I'm about to change the world.
Chapter 20. March 15th, 9:50 p.m. The Volga River, Russia. Tucker turned the conversation from world-changing scientific discoveries to more practical questions, like why someone was trying to kill them. Back to this General Harzin, Tucker said.
Since we are done with the lies, Bukalov said, I do know him. Not personally, just by reputation. I'm sorry, I do not trust people easily. It took me many months before I even told Anya about Luca.
What do you know about him? What's his reputation?
In a word, he's a monster. Back in the 80s, Harzin was in charge of Arzamas 16, outside of Kazan. After the military weapons research facility was shut down, its archives were transferred to the Institute of Biochemistry and Biophysics in Kazan.
And then, years later, they were moved into storage vaults at the Kazan Kremlin, Anya added.
All along, Harzin was a true believer in Luca. Though his scientists called it something different back then, but he only saw its destructive potential.
Which is?
What you must understand. The primordial world was once a much harsher place. In its original habitat, such a life form would have been highly aggressive.
It would have to be to survive. If let loose today with no defenses against it, I believe, as did Harzin, that it would be unstoppable.
Tucker was beginning to see the danger.
Bukalov continued,
Luca's primary purpose is to hijack nearby plant cells and modify them to match its own, so it can reproduce rapidly, much like a virus. It has the potential to be the world's most deadly and relentless invasive species.
Tucker understood how this could easily become a weapon. If released upon an enemy, it could wipe out the country's entire agricultural industry, devastating the land without a single shot being fired.
So, how far along are you with this research? He asked. You and Harzin.
In the past, we've been running parallel lines of research, trying to reverse engineer plant life to create Luca. Or a Luca-like organism in the lab. My goal was to better the world. His was to turn Luca into a weapon. But we both ran into two problems.
Which were what?
First, neither of us could create a viable specimen that was stable. Second, neither of us could figure out how to control such a life form if we succeeded.
Tucker nodded. For Harzin, his biological bomb needed an off switch.
Without it, he wouldn't be able to control it. He couldn't safely use it as a weapon.
If it is released without safeguards in place, Luca runs the risk of spreading globally, wiping out ecosystem after ecosystem. In the end, it could pose as much risk to Russia as Kharzin's enemies.
So what suddenly changed? Tucker asked. What set this manhunt in motion? Why do you need to leave Russia so suddenly? Clearly, the old impasse between the two of them had broken.
Because I believe I know where to find a sample of Luca, or at least its closest descendant.
Tucker nodded. And Kharzin learned of your discovery. He came after you.
I could not let him get to it first.
You understand that, yes?
He did. But where is the sample? How did you learn about it?
From Paulus the Clerk. The answer has been under our noses for over a century.
Tucker remembered Bukalov's story about the Boer botanist, about his journals being prized throughout the academic world.
You see, over the years, I've managed to collect portions of his diaries and journals, most of it in secret. Not an easy process, as the man created great volumes of papers and accounts, much of it scattered and lost or buried in unprocessed archives. But slowly, I was able to start collating the most pertinent sections, like those last papers Anya smuggled out of the Kremlin.
Tucker pictured the giant Prada bag clutched to her chest.
He kept a diary for decades, from the time he was a teenager until he died. Most of it is filled with the mundane details of life, but there was one journal during the Second Boer War that described a most fascinating and frightening observation. From the few drawings I could find, from his detailed research notes, I was sure he had discovered either a cluster of living Luca or something that acted just like the hypothetical life form.
Why do you think that?
It wasn't just me. In one page I found at a museum in Amsterdam, he described his discovery as the Ursprung von der Leben. In Afrikaans, it means the origin of life.
So what became of the sample? Where did he find it?
Some cave in the Transvaal. Some place he and his Boer unit retreated to.
They were pinned down there by British forces. It was during this siege that the clerk found the cluster of Luca. As a botanist and medical doctor, he was understandably intrigued. I don't have the complete story about what happened in that cave. It's like reading a novel with half the pages missing. But he hints at some great misery that befell their forces.
What happened to him?
Sadly, he would die in that cave, killed as the siege broke. The British troops eventually returned his belongings, including his journals and diary, to his widow. But past that, we know nothing. I'm still studying the documents Anya found. Perhaps some of the blanks will be filled in.
Is there any indication that de Klerk understood what he found?
No, not fully,
Anya replied.
But in the papers I was collecting when you came for me in the Kremlin, he finally named his discovery. The Apocalypse Sod.
The Apocalypse Seed, Bukalov translated.
Whatever he found scared him, but he was also intrigued, which explains his map.
What map?
To the location of the cave. It's encrypted in his diary. I suspect the clerk hoped he'd survive the siege and have a chance to return later to continue his research. Sadly, that wasn't to be.
And you have this map?
I do.
Where? Bukalov tapped his skull.
In here, I burned the original.
Tucker gaped at the doctor. No wonder everyone is after you. 10:18 p.m. After the discussion, Tucker needed some fresh air to clear his head. He and Kane stepped up on deck and waved to Vadim, who continued to man the boat's wheel. In return, he got a salute with the glowing tip of his cigar. Settled into the bow, Tucker listened to the waves slap the hull and stared longingly at the pinpricks of lights marking homes and farmsteads, life continuing simply. He considered calling Ruth Harper, but after all that had happened, he was wary. His satellite phone was supposed to be secure, but was any communication truly safe? He decided to err on the side of caution until he got to Volgograd. Footsteps sounded behind him. Kane stirred, then settled again.
"May I join you?"
Anya asked. Tucker gestured to the deck beside him. She sat down, then scooted away a few inches.
"I'm sorry we lied to you," she said.
"Water under the boat."
"Don't you mean under the bridge?"
"Context," Tucker said, getting a nervous laugh out of the woman.
"It's nice to see that."
"Me laughing? I'll have you know I laugh all the time. You just haven't seen me at my best of late."
She hesitated.
"And I'm afraid I'm about to make that worse."
He glanced over to her.
"What is it?"
"Do you promise not to shoot me or throw me off the boat?"
"I can't promise that, but out with it, Anya. I've had enough surprises for one day."
"I'm SVR," she said.
Tucker blew his breath out slowly, trying to wrap his head around this.
"It stands for..."
"I know what it stands for. Služba vnešní rozvědky.
It was Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, their equivalent of the CIA. "Agent or officer?" he asked.
"Agent, for the last 6 years, but I do have a degree in biochemistry. That's real enough. It's why they sent me."
"Sent you to get close to Bukalov?"
"Yes."
"And you're pretty," Tucker added. "Perfect bait for the older, widowed professor."
"It was never like that,"
Anya snapped.
"They told me to seduce him if necessary, but I couldn't do it. Besides, it proved unnecessary. The doctor is consumed with his work. My interest and aid was enough to gain his trust."
Tucker decided he believed her.
"What was the SVR after? Luca?"
"No, not exactly. We knew Abram was working on something important, that he was close to a breakthrough, and given who he is, they wanted to know more about what he was working on."
"And now they do," Tucker replied. "When are they coming? Where's the ambush point?"
"That's just it. They're not coming. I've strung them along, believe this or not. But I believe in what he is doing. When I found out what he was trying to accomplish, I changed my mind. I'm still a scientist at heart. He genuinely wants to use Luca for good. Months ago, I decided I wasn't about to hand over something that important. Since then, I've been feeding my superiors false information."
"Does Bukalov know?"
"No. It is a distraction he does not need. Completing his work must come first."
"What do you know about Harzin?"
"This is the first I've heard of his involvement here, but I do know his reputation. He's ruthless, very old school, surrounds himself with like-minded ideologues, all Soviet hardliners."
"What about your superiors? Have you been in contact with them since I got you out of the Kremlin?"
"No, you took our phones."
"What about in Dmitrovgrad, when you disappeared?"
"Tea," Anya replied. "I really was just getting tea. I didn't break communication silence, I swear."
"Why should I believe you about any of this?"
"I can't offer any concrete proof, but ask yourself this. If I were still in contact with the SVR and my loyalties had not changed, why aren't they here?"
Tucker conceded her argument was solid.
"My real name is Anya Averin. You can have your superiors confirm what I'm saying. When we reach Volgograd, turn me over to your people. Let them debrief me. I've told you the truth."
Anya's voice took on a pleading but determined tone.
Only Abram knows where the clerk's cave is. He never told me. Ask him. Once you get Abram out of the country and under U.S. protection, Luca is safe from everyone. The SVR, General Harzin, all of them.
Tucker stared across the waters at the small, slumbering homesteads along the banks, free of such skullduggery. How did spies live in this world and keep their sanity?
What are you going to do?
Anya asked. I'll keep your secret from Bukulov for now, but only until we reach the border. She gave him a nod of thanks. For a second, he considered throwing her overboard anyway, but quashed the impulse. After she left, Tucker grabbed a sleeping bag and a blanket and found a nook on the boat's forecastle. Kane curled up on the blanket and closed his eyes. Tucker tried to do the same, but failed. He stared at the passing view, watched the moon rise above the banks. Kane had a dream, making soft noises and twitching his back legs. Tucker tried to picture their destination. Volgograd. He knew the city's infamous history when it used to be called Stalingrad. During World War II, a major battle occurred there between the German Wehrmacht and the Soviet Red Army. It lasted 5 months, leaving Stalingrad in rubble and 2 million dead or wounded. And that's where I hope to find salvation. No wonder he couldn't sleep. Chapter 21. March 16th, 6:05 a.m. The Volga River, Russia. With sunrise still 2 hours away, the river remained dark, mottled with patches of fog. But a distant glow rising ahead, at the horizon line, marked their approach toward Volgograd. As they motored along the current, the lights of the city slowly appeared, spreading across the banks of the river to either side, then spilling out into the surrounding steppes. Tucker checked his watch, then retrieved his satellite phone and dialed Sigma. Once Harper was on the line, Tucker brought her up to speed about everything, including Anya's confession from last night.
I'll look into her, Harper promised.
We should be in the city proper in another hour or so. What do you have waiting for us?
Harper hesitated a moment. Try to keep an open mind about this.
Whenever a sentence starts that way, I get nervous.
What do you know about ecotourism?
Next to nothing.
Well, that area of Russia has become something of a mecca for it, especially the Volga. Apparently, the huge river is home to plant and animal life that's found in few other places. Consequently, a cottage business has sprung up in Volgograd. Submarine eco-tours.
You're kidding. The Russians don't strike me as the eco-friendly type.
Still, at last count, there are 11 companies that offer such tours. They make up a fleet of about 40 electric mini-subs. Each holds 6 passengers and 1 pilot, with a depth rating of 30 feet. Aside from conducting monthly safety checks, the government is hands-off. The subs come and go as they please.
I like the sound of that.
Tucker could guess the rest.
Sigma must have found a tour company that was strapped for cash and was willing to take a private party on an extended tour of the Volga. After she passed on the details, Tucker hung up and went aft to speak with Vadim.
Do you speak English? Tucker asked.
Yes, some. Eve speaks slow.
Tucker explained as best he could, much of it involving pantomiming. He should have woken Utkin to help with the translation. But finally, Vadim grinned and nodded.
Ah, the Volga Don Canal. Yes, I know it. I find the boat you meet. 3 hours, da?
Da.
We make it. No worry. You and dog go now.
It seemed Tucker had been dismissed. He went below to find everyone awake and eating a simple breakfast of tea, black bread, and hard cheese.
Bukulov asked,
So, Tucker, what is your plan? How are you going to get me out of the country?
It's all been arranged. He held off mentioning the unusual means of transportation, not because of fear that the information might leak to the wrong ears, but simply to avoid a mutiny. Instead, he bucked up as much confidence as he could muster and said, "We're almost home free." 8:13 a.m. 90 minutes later, Vadim called down the ladder.
"We are here."
Tucker led the group topside, where they found the world had been whitewashed away, swallowed by a thick, dense fog. To the east, the sun was a dull disk in the overcast sky. All around, out of the mists, buoys clanged and horns blew. Flowing dark shadows marked passing boats, gliding up and down the Volga. Vadim had them anchored near the shore, the engine in neutral.
"It is eerie, all this fog,"
Anya said.
"But good for us, yes?" Bukalov asked.
Tucker nodded. Vadim resumed his post at the wheel and said something to Utkin.
"He says your friends are late."
Tucker checked his watch. "Not by much. They'll be here." They stood in the fog, not talking, waiting. Then an engine with an angry pitch grew louder, coming toward them. A moment later, the sharp nose of a speedboat glided out of the fog off the port bow. The speedboat drew a beam and a gaff hook appeared and latched onto their gunwale. With a hand on his pocketed magnum, Tucker crossed to the port side and cautiously peeked over the rail. A bald, round-faced man with two gold front teeth smiled and handed a slip of paper up to Tucker. 9 alphanumeric characters had been scrawled on it. Tucker checked them carefully, then handed across his own slip of paper with a similar string of symbols, which the stranger studied before nodding. It was a coded means of verifying each other, arranged by Harper.
"You are Tucker?"
the man asked.
"I am." "That must mean you are Misha?"
He got another gold-tinged smile, and Misha stepped back and waved his hand to the speedboat.
"Thank you for choosing Wild Volga Tours."
Tucker collected the others, paid Vadim, then herded everyone onto the other boat. Misha eyed Kane skeptically as Tucker hauled him down.
"Is he wolf?" "He thinks so sometimes, but he's well-trained."
"And all the more dangerous for it," Tucker added silently. His reassurance seemed to satisfy the boatman.
"Come, follow me."
They set off into the fog, seeming to go much faster than was wise considering the visibility. They wove in and around the river traffic. Even Tucker found himself clinging tightly to one of the boat's hand grips. Finally, the engine changed pitch and the boat slowed. Misha angled toward shore, and a dock appeared out of the mist. He eased them alongside the tire bumpers. Men appeared out of the fog and secured the mooring lines.
"We go now,"
Misha said, and hopped to the pier. Tucker led the others and followed their guide through the fog down a wide boardwalk that spanned a swampy area. At the end rose a Quonset hut with pale yellow walls and a riveted roof streaked with so much rust it looked like an abstract painting. The group stepped inside. To their left, a pair of red and blue miniature submarines sat atop maintenance scaffolding. The subs were 30 feet long and 7 wide, with portholes lining the hull, including along the bottom. Amidships, a waist-high conning tower rose, topped by a hand-wheel-operated entry hatch. Below this, jutting from the sub's sides, were a pair of adjustable control planes. At the bow was a clear, bulbous cone, which Tucker assumed was the pilot's seat. Tucker turned to the others, who were staring open-mouthed at the subs, and said,
"Your chariots."
No one spoke.
"Impressive, da?"
Misha said cheerily.
"You're joking, right?"
Utkin asked.
"Is this how we're leaving Volgograd?"
And this from the most pliable of the group. Bukalov and Anya remained speechless.
"They're so very small,"
Utkin continued.
"But comfortable," And well-stocked,
Misha countered.
And reliable. It may take a while to reach your destination, but we will get you there. To date, we have had only 3 accidents.
Anya finally found her voice.
Accidents? What kind of accidents?
No injuries or fatalities. Power outages,
Misha shrugged.
We got craned out of the river before the Volga mud swallowed us.
Anya turned a pleading look toward Tucker.
This is your plan? I am not...
Surprisingly, Bukalov became the voice of reason, stepping to Anya and curling an arm around her shoulders.
Anya, I am sure it is perfectly safe.
She did not look convinced. Leaving the others in the maintenance bay to ogle the submarines, Misha led Tucker into a side office. There, Misha's friendly grin disappeared.
What your people have asked is very difficult. Do you know how far away the Caspian Sea is?
282 miles, Tucker replied. Taking into account the cruising speed of your submarines, the average recharge time for the sub's batteries, and the seasonal current of the Volga, we should reach the Caspian in 18 to 24 hours.
I see, he grumbled. You are well informed.
And you're being well paid. Before Misha could reply, Tucker added, I understand the risk you're taking, and I'm grateful. So I'm prepared to offer you a bonus. 10,000 rubles if you get us there safely. On one condition.
I am listening.
You're our pilot. You personally.
Take it or leave it.
He wanted more than a financial gamble by the owner of Wild Volga Tours. He wanted his skin involved in the game, too. Misha stared hard at Tucker, then stuck out his hand.
Done. We leave in 1 hour.